Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner. I'm Sam Minter. Oh, wait. Yeah, welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner. I'm Sam Minter. Today I've got with me Bruce Morton. Hello, Bruce.
Hello.
As I mentioned,
yes, you're still Sam Minter.
I still am, although sometimes I get really confused, you know. But it is Tuesday, June 3rd, just after 4 UTC, recording it at a little bit different time of week.
Oh, that's right. I get so confused on that UTC thing.
Yeah. It's the universal time zone for the world.
Yes, I understand it, and I totally would agree with you, but, you know, I don't think that you are going to be able to persuade the rest of the world to follow your thing. I mean, luck, but I ain't going to happen.
Yeah, probably, but, you know, I got to keep trying. And I know at least occasionally we have had, you know, European listeners who are a little bit closer to that time zone. But anyway, as I mentioned last week, Yvonne is out for this week. He was out last week as well, and still dealing with repairs on his house. Hopefully he'll be back with us next week. But so Bruce graciously volunteered to join us this week, and we've got a few things on the agenda. We'll do our usual little chatting at the top. We're going to talk about this situation with the POW Bergdahl, there was a trade and all kinds of interesting things going on surrounding that. Bruce has also been experimenting with life logging, and we mentioned that in passing a few weeks back, and Bruce recently posted a review of a piece of hardware he has for that, and we'll talk about that.
Actually, a couple pieces of hardware. But yeah.
Oh, a couple pieces of hardware. That's right.
Yeah, we'll talk about it because on our tweet, going back and forth,
the pen.
I also mentioned the pen, yeah.
Yeah. So that'll be good. And then some follow-up from last week, and maybe if we'll have time, we'll mention what's been going on with the minimum wage in Seattle. You mentioned up front you had some chit-chat to start things off with.
Yes, I'm so glad that I was able to prod you enough to get you to change your smoke alarm battery. I cannot believe that you've literally gone months and months with that thing.
I think
chirping.
Years and years would be accurate.
Oh, that is so crazy. How could you stand that?
Well, you see, like, after maybe the first week we were in the house, I never noticed it again, except when you guys mentioned it from listening to the show, because you just tune it out. I mean, I guess I would know that it was there occasionally, but it no longer registered in a way that, like, you know, I would even think twice about it, because you get used to it, I guess. And
bizarre.
And, you know, after the first couple, you know, when we first moved into this house, I'm pretty sure it was like that from the moment we moved into this house, which was about two and a half, three years ago. I'm pretty sure it was like that when we moved in. And the first few days, I noticed it all the time, and I'm like, I gotta fix that. I gotta fix that. And then I used our ladder, and it wasn't tall enough, and I couldn't reach it. And I'm like, okay, I guess I need a new ladder. And then other things came up, and I never got a new ladder, and that was that. Until, you know, but yes, a couple hours ago, I brought the ladder upstairs. I pulled it out. I climbed up the thing at great risk to my life, I must say. You know, it's tall, you know, but no, and I changed the battery. And I believe the beep has stopped. I waited up there at the top of the ladder for 3 or 4 minutes just to make sure there was no beep before getting back down. The second time. I actually got down first.
And you really had to focus to make sure that you actually heard it, because, you know, you might have to.
Exactly. I asked my wife to listen too, please. You know, and but yeah, I actually went up the first time, and I came back down, and I put the ladder away, and then I heard the beep again, only to realize, of course, I'd put the battery in backwards, so I had to go back up. But anyway, that is taken care of now.
The other thing, big thing for us and our family, people probably don't care, but my oldest son, Bryce, just earned his Eagle Award, and we had his Eagle Court of Honor last weekend.
Very good.
And so we're very proud of him. He did all the merit badges that are necessary, and he did his big service project, which was picnic tables for a local park here, and we did the full flag ceremony and gave him an award and had a slideshow with all his pictures from the scout experience. So that was a really big deal, and I think it'll be good for him, and it's a good thing for his resume and good experiences.
Congratulations.
So
one thing before we get to the comments about last week's show, I did want to mention, when I did the rundown of topics, our listeners will notice one thing notably missing, which is Apple's WWDC conference. We are saving that. I will talk about that with Yvonne next week, because Bruce just isn't an Apple guy. He's a Windows and Android guy, which is a perspective you usually don't hear on our show, but it's not one of our topics today probably, but we'll save all the Apple stuff for next time.
I'm not like a religious zealot or anyone who's Apple is like evil, but it just has no interest for me.
Yeah. Okay, so comments from last week. You said had some thoughts on the self-driving cars and on Snowden.
Yeah, just a couple things. It almost made me cry when I saw that video. It just evoked emotion to me, like, oh, that is going to be
Google
so...
Video?
Yeah, the Google video of the self-driving car, their little pod. It really shows that the world will, when self-driving cars come along and are widely available, it'll literally change the world. I mean, I think the change in the world will be equivalent to the change when people started getting their own cars, when cars replaced horse and buggy. Because cars will become these transportation pods that will just move around autonomously. And I fully agree with you about people won't really need to buy a car. They'll just get in a car. Just think of the Google car merged with Uber.
Right.
And where you call it up on your app, on your phone, and you tell it where you want to go, and it'll take you there. Now, one comment that I saw on an article about that was that it's really not, you really can't have a personal vehicle be like that with no steering wheel, because if you, say you want to just take it out of your garage and move it over out of the way so that you can work in the garage, how would you give that direction without a steering wheel? It'd be so cumbersome to say to your car, I want you to move back and over a few feet. You just want to get the steering wheel and move it. Or
I don't know. I could see them making that fairly easy, though. I mean, I could see, though, and I imagine for regulatory purposes, you're probably always going to, at least initially, you're going to have systems with some sort of manual override, even if it's not like your normal full-fledged steering wheel and pedals and stuff. Like, even the pods they were talking about in some of the interviews, they mentioned that in the initial rounds of testing, they're going to have like a little plug-in joystick module that they can use to override the car. And their plan is to get to the point where that's not necessary at all. But I mentioned sort of government getting out of the way and regulations and all this kind of stuff. One of the places I could see that coming into play is requiring certain of these manual features to be there regardless. Another place that I could see it coming into play is you mentioned, the combination with Uber and, you only have to look at Uber and traditional taxi services and the huge amount of effort that the traditional taxi services are putting into keeping Uber out of various places to know that, if this becomes a clear threat, and I think it will be, that you're going to have all kinds of entrenched interests lobbying with everything they have to restrict this technology in various ways or add things that make it more cumbersome and expensive to use. And I think that's going to be one of the clear battles that generates over this thing is, from the people who don't want it to happen because it'll hurt them economically versus all the people that this would help immensely.
And think about truck drivers.
Yeah.
I have a brother who's a truck driver, the long distance, drives all over the country.
Yep.
That type of job, its days are numbered.
Yeah, I think that's clear. We had this conversation over Twitter a few months ago in terms of automation and what the impacts are on jobs. You know, certain types of jobs are going to go away, you know, and then the question is, how does the economy restructure around that change? But bus drivers, taxi drivers, truck drivers, delivery. I mean, you talk about drones for delivering packages. That's not going to be the flying drones. You have driving drones to do that.
Yeah.
You true. Know.
One other thing is, imagine if all cars are self-driving, you can get rid of traffic lights.
Yeah,
because cars will just flow through, just like a band on a football field. They'll just flow through each other.
There was a simulation sometime in the last year on exactly that topic with, you know, what would traffic look like in a situation where you have not just self-driving cars, but cars that potentially communicate with each other in a network, so they're always broadcasting their intentions so that they can collaboratively plan what they're doing. And you have, it looks like utter chaos, but everything, exactly like you said, just flows right through. You know, they make sure they don't hit each other, but, you know, it from the point of view of a human driver, it looks terrifying.
You close your eyes when you're going through the intersection.
Exactly.
Imagine going 55 through with the car passing you by inches.
Exactly. But and traffic jams as well, because, you know, you eliminate sort of rubbernecking. You eliminate, you can plan around all of the how merges happen and everything else, and you eliminate a lot of the follow distance can be a lot closer if the cars are coordinating with each other.
Road capacities go up, so that saves government money. They don't have to build as many roads. They don't have to widen roads. They'll just be excellent in so many areas. That'll be more jobs that'll be lost. Road construction crews. Ooh.
Yeah, well, and people have mentioned, you know, it completely can change your infrastructure for, you know, for gas stations or charging stations or whatever replaces them, because right now those have to be, those are strategically placed along major transportation routes where real estate is more expensive, etc. With self-driving cars, you don't need to do that because you can send your car off to go get gas while you're doing something else. And it can drive a couple miles out of the way to someplace that's cheaper real estate, which will drive down the cost of fuel as well. So yeah. There are all kinds of implications of these changes. Like I said last week, it's getting to the point where it's so close you can taste it. There was an interesting article I tweeted in the last couple of days, where, you know, someone pointed out that the mechanism that Google has used for this is actually very innovative compared to previous approaches, because obviously people have been studying the notion of self-driving cars for decades now and optimizing this behavior. But most of the previous approaches all had a matter of the car trying to figure out what to do based only on what it could see. And maybe some GPS and some rudimentary maps. But what Google has done specifically, and the article mentioned that right now these self-driving cars can only drive in Mountain View, California, because what Google has done is they have generated super, super high-resolution maps of the entire city that maps every curve down to within a couple centimeters.
Yes, and I think I remember reading in there how the cars themselves build the database as they're driving.
Yep.
So it's a self-healing type of database, kind of like they're turning, it's like their whole mindset of a web crawler.
Yep.
It's a road crawler.
Exactly. And so every car is constantly reporting home everything it's seen, every change that's going on, and the car doesn't have to figure out as much on its own, because it needs to just get enough information to place itself within this larger map and look out for changes and moving obstacles, like people, bicycles, other cars, things like that. It doesn't have to figure out where the roads are, because after it initially turns on and locates itself, it knows all that. And that's all from its the built-in database. Now, of course, this has
mentioned in there even that it doesn't even need to know what the lights are, when they turn green or red. It just
imputes that by the behavior of the other drivers.
Exactly.
And of course, the other thing is, when we talk about privacy and big data and all of this kind of thing, if you imagine a network where a huge fraction of the cars on the road are plugged into Google's network, constantly reporting everything they see, obviously that has some implications that we'd want to be careful of. But like with everything else these companies do, there's this huge trade-off here of, okay, they're going to build this huge database with all kinds of information that obviously could be exploited in all kinds of perhaps bad ways if somebody wanted to. But on the other hand, you get your damn self-driving cars.
Exactly. Yeah.
So anyway, you also had some comments on Snowden.
I think that's good for now. I mean, I would like to talk to them, but I think we have other things to talk about, so.
Okay, well, then let's take a break, and we'll be back, and we'll talk about one of the other things. Back after this. Sure. This is Sam here with an opportunity for you. Yes, you heard me right, an opportunity. For you loyal listeners of Curmudgeon's Corner, you know, every once in a while, Yvonne can't make a show. And I do a solo show, which, I think I do okay. But, it's always interesting to have a second person to bounce off. And just in general, sometimes it's good to hear another voice. If you, yes, you, have some things to say about the kinds of things we usually talk about on Curmudgeon's Corner, politics, current events, news, tech, then drop me a line at abelsmay@abelsmay.com letting me know. And hey, I'll keep you in mind and maybe ask if you can join us sometime, either on a regular show with Yvonne if it's something particularly pressing that you maybe have an expertise on, or just, an opportunity to co-host when Yvonne is out. Who knows? Now, I am not guaranteeing that if you send me an email, you'll definitely get on the show, but let me know if you're interested and I'll keep you in mind. Thanks, and now, back to the show. Okay, we're back. So, what do you want to do first, Bergdahl or life logging?
Let's do life logging.
Okay, let me just start with, so the general concept of this is that you have devices that you keep with you and are basically capable of, you just turn on recording, essentially. So it's not like you pick up your camera and you decide to take a picture, or you decide to take a video, or you decide to record the audio from a specific event. You just have these things with you and, by default on, essentially, recording everything that's going on. And then after the fact, you can sort of figure out what's interesting to keep. Is that the basic idea here?
Yeah, it's kind of like, the whole idea of just data mining, recording everything and then data mining it after the fact to get interesting or useful information now that I may need later. And just parenthetically, I've learned about this Momoto or narrative. It used to be called Momoto. I learned this from you. I saw a tweet from you. Yes, when it was a Kickstarter project. I saw you mentioned that Brandy would never let you have one because he wouldn't want you to take pictures in the house. Well, my wife's the same way. I take it off when I come home, and it has no buttons on it, no switches. It's just all it is it has a USB port on it, four LEDs, and a camera lens on it.
And so what you wear this? Do you wear it like? Is it like you wear it around your neck, or you put it on a pocket? How? What?
You can. You have a lot of options. It's got a sheet metal type clip, and it clips fairly easily into a pocket. You just kind of slide it on there, and it's, you have to be careful that not to clip it onto fabric that's too thin, because the clip is not like super strong. And so it can easily be knocked off. And on my article, I show that I put a label on it and with my name and email address and stuff. And yeah, so in case
so give your URL to point people to.
Okay, sure. My blog is contrarianconformist.blogspot.com.
There you go.
And it's the latest post on there.
Posted on June 2nd for anyone listening later.
Yeah, and so the narrative camera, it takes a picture every 30 seconds, and if it's face down on a table, or if it sees black, it doesn't take a picture, so it'll conserve power and memory that way. And when it's out, it's taking pictures. And after a day or two, I synchronize it, and it uploads all the pictures to the cloud. And once it does that, then I can view all the pictures on my phone or tablet.
Now, does it try to, like, be smart about figuring out, like, sort of, this was an interesting time, or does it just, here's everything?
It does. They do have this algorithm where, first of all, they divide everything by moments, what they call moments. Basically, they take pictures that are taken in a particular place and time altogether. Like if I go to the store, and then I go to the park, and then I go to the gas station, it would make three moments out of that, because it would notice that it sees a different lighting level, it sees that I'm in a different location, because it's got a GPS inside there too, so it knows where it's at. And so once it bunches those into kind of folders, these moment folders, it does attempt to pick out the interesting pictures, but I found that it doesn't really do a good job. Their algorithm for finding good pictures versus boring pictures is not very good. Now, if I were to sit in front of my computer all day with the camera on, yeah, it would filter out these repetitive pictures. But I never wear when I'm sitting in front of a computer or in a boring location.
When you're using this, like you don't actually like wear it 24/7. You're putting it on when you're doing something that you think might be interesting, or how do you decide when to do this and when not to?
Yeah, initially at first I was wearing it everywhere for the first few days, but then I realized this is useless to have it, you know, taking pictures of just walls and my computer screen. So basically what I do is I wear it whenever I'm out, whenever I'm not home and not at work. I have put it on my dashboard in my car so that it can record where I'm traveling, which is kind of interesting. But I don't do that as much now. Basically, I just whenever I'm in I'm just out and about, or whenever I have like a party here at the house or something, I'll wear it.
Now,
so
is this conspicuous? Do people just walking by you in the grocery store notice it?
Yes and no. First of all, it is not a spy camera. It is meant to be worn on the out in the open. It's about the size, I'd say it's about an inch by an inch.
Okay.
So it's not like maybe an inch and a half by an inch and a half. It's not inconspicuous. I've found that most people don't notice it.
Okay.
Because people are not really focused on it. But I do find that maybe about, there are maybe 10 to 20% of the people, that's they'll focus in on it right away, and they'll just go right up to me and say, "What is that?" And then I'll tell them. And really, I expected there to be people that would be like, "Oh, don't take pictures of me. Oh, I don't think that's a really good thing." People that would be offended or want to avoid me. I have not found any of that. I've actually been surprised that people are actually, when I tell them about it, they're like, "Oh, that's really cool." Or other people will say, "Oh, that's really geeky." And a few people have said, "Oh, yeah, I really want to have something like that." Now, in my review, I mentioned that my main gripe on this camera is that it uses a standard cell phone camera that has a 70-degree field of view. And so that is very narrow. So basically, when I wear it, it has to be perfectly perpendicular to the ground. Otherwise, I get ceilings or floors, and people's heads get cut off. And so I'm really flabbergasted that the designers of this thing, they were more interested in taking pretty pictures rather than capturing everything that a person sees. Because in my review, I take a picture with the narrative camera on the free throw line of a basketball court. And then I take a picture with a GoPro from the exact same spot to compare how much more could be seen if they had chosen a wide-angle lens. Basically, if it had been like I think it's a 110, no, I think it's like a 200, no, not 200, I forget what the field of view is for the GoPro, but it's much wider. You could really capture everything that you see, but of course the pictures are a little distorted.
Right.
So, but that's the choice they made, and hopefully in the next version it'll be good.
Overall, when I read your review, I was like, this thing seems like it's not quite ready for prime time.
No, I think they're marketing it wrong. When you think of just impromptu pictures, really what you're thinking about is where the picture is taken and framed intentionally, but the subject of the picture doesn't know that they're being photographed or they're doing something interesting.
Right.
But when the person who's taking the picture and the person who's getting the picture don't know when or how how the picture is being framed, you get these random pictures that maybe you might find something interesting every once in a while, but it's really just all it's really good for is capturing data, which is really what I want. I want to be able to look up, when was the last time I saw this person? When was the last time I was here? When was the last time I went golfing? When was the last time I did such and such a thing? And so what I'm hoping, they don't have this now, what I'm hoping is that they will build into their service, which is the first year is free and then it's $9 a month, that they'll start putting in facial recognition where it'll say tie in with my address book, so that I can say, when bring up all the moments when I've met this person, and which can be very valuable. I mean, it's kind of like a Google for my own personal life, because I can't go into Google and say, when was the last time I did this such and such. But, potentially with this device, I could.
Now, do you think, like, for the kind of application you're talking about, it almost seems like, you'd be better off just integrating with calendars and attaching the metadata sort of in a text format instead of basing that off pictures or something like that. As opposed to, like, if your goal is to sort of get interesting spontaneous snapshots, okay, you need a camera. But if you're trying to see, hey, when's the last time I saw Bob? If you just make sure you put Bob in your calendar when you meet him, then you do have a searchable database for that for almost any calendar system.
Yeah, but nobody is ever going to put, well, maybe most people are not going to put every personal encounter in their calendar.
Right, because you'll put in the meetings, but you're not going to put in, I saw Bob at the grocery store and I talked to him for 5 minutes before I checked out.
Exactly. The whole idea of this thing is to automate it. I think the whole idea of life logging is to automate recording of your life so that you can get on with your life and not have to worry about, journaling and things like that.
Hmm. Yeah, because I guess the one thing I still am trying to sort of figure out from these, because I can, from the geeky point of view and from the point of view of someone who likes tracking things and likes, logging all kinds of things, I get the appeal of having sort of the permanent record of something. I've often said, like, if I could have just a permanent record of everything I see and hear for my entire life that I could rewind and view and whatever whenever I felt like it, that would be awesome. I'd love that. Especially if it was searchable and, all
that. Have you seen that movie Final Cut with Robin Williams?
I don't think I have.
Oh, you really need to see that.
Basically the theme?
That is the whole idea. See, as Robin Williams plays this guy who, it's in this world where people have such a device.
Right.
And their entire life is recorded. And what he does is, after they die, he condenses their entire life into this beautiful life summary video. And they build the story around that.
Oh, that does sound good. I will have to add it to my very long list of movies to watch once I retire.
Yes.
But anyway, aside from sort of the geeky individual who is really into the self-tracking and logging and all of this kind of stuff, what is the benefit? Like, is there any benefit that would make this possibly break into the mainstream?
Well, here's where I can segue into another life logging device that I use that has maturity and is very useful.
Okay.
And it is the LiveScribe pen. And it's a pen that records while you write, and it uses it has an infrared camera in the tip, so that you, when you write on this special paper, it basically scans everything that you write, so that it creates a digital copy when you synchronize the pen with your desktop PC, so that you simultaneously have written text or written word on paper, and you have it recorded in an image on your computer. And the benefit of that is that all my notes from all my meetings are searchable. I can then go to the notes, like if I'm looking for a certain particular word, a keyword in a meeting, I can then tap on that word and it will play back the audio that was spoken during the meeting.
Ooh, that's nice.
It is very nice. Now, I've been using this device for 6 years now. I'm on my second pen, because the first one kind of died after being charged hundreds of times. And I have basically recorded most of my meetings in all that time. And so I can go back, I can search my notes. I have horrible handwriting, and it doesn't do text. It doesn't do text recognition. It does pattern matching. Okay. So if I search for a word, it looks for letters, even cursive letters that match.
Well, so, that means it could also look for a specific diagram or something you'd drawn, right?
No, it doesn't do searches on diagrams, but I can. There's a way to put a bookmark on items as you're writing. But yeah, so now when it comes to recording all these meetings, do I listen to all my meetings second time? No, it's very rare. Actually, I'd say 99% of the recordings that I make, I never go back to them. But for that 1%. Where I need to go back and listen to what is said, especially in a meeting where they're talking about stuff that I'm that's new to me, or if it's like it's a new project or some new assignment, or there's some new terminology that I have no idea what's going on. I don't have to worry while I'm in the meeting. I just write down the word, and I have my own personal system where if there's something that I want to go back to, I mark it, and then I can go back to it. I can hear what was said, and I can play it back fast. I can play it back slow. I can look it up and all that stuff. And there's also this. You mentioned how in your work you wouldn't be able to use that, and I can see how maybe in some businesses you.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine like my place of employment is very, very sensitive about any information leaking out. You're not supposed to use like services like Dropbox or Evernote or any of those kinds of things for internal work stuff, because what it means is your information about whatever's going on inside ends up on somebody else's server. But more to the point on this, I don't know if it has any cloud integration like that, or it's just your local computer. But even if it was just your local computer, I would imagine that people would get very sensitive about the fact that they're being recorded. And, Even more so than you with the camera walking around the grocery store, because now this is, you know, this is the work meeting, there, whatever's going on, and, you know, is everything on the record all the time? Do you want to have your exact words thrown back at you 3 months later? You know, what?
I would think so too, but maybe it's just the culture at where I work, but everyone's okay with it. And I've been actually kind of surprised. In fact, I'll give you an example. Once I was in a meeting, let me just step back. I have a personal policy with the use of this pen that I will not share any of the recordings. I will not let anyone listen to the recordings. I store them on my local computer,
right,
and they don't go on cloud, unless I have specific, permission from the person that I would like to share. And I was once in a meeting with the VP of engineering, and he said something that I wanted to share. And so I emailed him after the fact, and I said, hey, I recorded the meeting, and you said something I'd like to share, would it be okay? And he was like, oh yeah, totally fine. Yeah, I could see how some people may be uncomfortable with it, but I've just never experienced that. And actually, I had to look up the laws for recording, and state by state, there's different laws about who you can record and what under what circumstances, what permissions and such. In the state of Washington, you just have to notify. So you don't have to have their permission. You just have to let them know.
Right. So everybody being recorded has to know they're being recorded, but... And so they have the option to decide not to talk or whatever, but you don't have to turn it off if they don't want to be recorded.
Exactly. And so I'm in meetings with the same groups of people over and over again. And whenever I'm in a meeting with someone new, I show them the pen. I explain it very briefly, but I don't have to do it over and over for every meeting, because everyone knows if I've got the pen, I'm recording.
So now the other thing that's interesting to me about this, I think that the technology is very interesting, and I could certainly see situations in my work life, if people agreed to such things, where it would be good to be able to go back and get what was the exact thing they took, because even if I'm taking notes, I may get the general gist of something, but maybe I missed the specifics or whatever. I can't remember the last time I've taken notes on paper, as opposed to into a laptop or a tablet or something like that, where I'm typing as opposed to handwriting. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I've gotten completely out of the habit. Like if I'm actually writing something with a pen for more than a few seconds, my hand starts saying, "What are you doing?" You know, like. I mean, maybe once a year, I'll write something as long as a paragraph by hand, but everything else is typed. Is that something where you've actively kept up? And I mean, obviously, this tool is geared around handwriting.
Yes, absolutely. I take more notes now than I ever did before, and because I know my notes are useful. And it's changed the way that I record, that I take notes, because now when I'm in a meeting, I don't have to write down all the details. I just need to write down the topic of what was being spoken.
Right.
And as long as I know the topic, I can search on that topic and go back to it and search it. Now, yeah, when it comes to, I see people who are like that. They take notes on their laptop. The thing I don't like about that is that it puts a screen between
you and the person you're talking to,
exactly. And a lot of times, when you get into these meetings where you see people, they're checking their email, and are they taking notes or are they paying attention or what? The nice thing is, you know, when it's me in a room with someone else or with a group of people, I'm paying full attention. I'm writing down everything that's being written. There's no distractions that can be on the screen.
Yeah, and you mentioned that, and it's very much a factor. I mean, like, the culture where I work is absolutely... If you go into a meeting with, you know, 10 people, let's say, guaranteed 9 of them will flip open their laptops during the meeting and be talking. And you can also be guaranteed that 9 of them are not taking notes. you know, they're keeping an eye on other things that are going on. They're looking at their email. They might be doing something else. They're tuning in and out. They're multitasking. There are all kinds of things going on. And, you know, for certain types of meetings, well, that's probably fine. Like if you're doing sort of a team status meeting and
you have a peripheral interest.
Yeah,
so you
only have to sort of really fully pay 100% attention when it's like your stuff being talked about, and the rest of the time it's okay to just sort of half pay attention and just keep an ear out. Okay, maybe you're actually increasing productivity by letting people multitask there, but it definitely is a different kind of culture and environment than in a place where you go into the room and, you know, nobody takes out the devices and you're all just talking to each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, or working on a project.
I think it gives me an actual advantage from everyone else. I'm able to comprehend and capture more of what's going on in meetings than most of the people.
Because you're more fully paying attention to what's actually going on around you.
And I've got a recording of the meeting.
That's true. So. Now, before we move on, one other thing you mentioned briefly, special paper.
Yes. I had been following this technology from way back in the, like, 2001. Wire magazine gave an overview of this technology developed in Sweden called Anoto, A-N-O-T-O. And it's basically the paper has a microscopic grid. Maybe not microscopic, but a very fine grid. You have to look really close of dots. But the dots aren't perfectly on a grid. They're offset.
Okay.
Slightly. And the pattern that of this paper, it forms an addressable space. And the size of the addressable space is the size of the continent, of the supercontinent of Eurasia.
Okay.
So imagine taking the piece of paper the size of Eurasia and slicing it up into 8.5 by 11, or even 5.5 by 8.5 sheets of paper. And then this little infrared camera, as you're writing, this infrared camera that's on the tip of your pen, as you're writing, it sees where it is in that grid pattern, and it knows exactly where in that addressable space that it is. And so as you're writing, it's just a matter of recording the points that the pen is passing through in that addressable space. And so it's just a matter, and so it records all that data, and then it can convert that into an image when you upload it.
Okay. So, of the two technologies, I think, you know, what's interesting to me of these two reviews is actually the first of the two, the life logging camera, is actually more interesting to me on the sort of the merits. I like the idea of having sort of the live record of everything I do, or at least everything I do in places where people let me take pictures. I like that idea, and I think that's really cool, but it sounds like it's not quite implemented in a smooth enough way to really work well yet. I mean, there are lots of deficiencies you pointed out, whereas the other with the pen sounds like that is pretty mature and looks good, and it's very... I'm like, this is cool. I would love to use this, except then I think about like the actual environment I'm in and the meetings I'm in and things like that. And I'm like, I don't think it would actually end up being useful for me, but not because of any deficiency in the technology, but just because it doesn't match the culture of what I'm in usually. I like the pen. The pen looks cool.
They really gear it towards students.
Yeah, no, and I can see that. And I have a vague memory when you talk about this that at some point, one of these years when my daughter was in high school, my wife talking about getting one of these things for her, and we didn't end up getting it, and I forget why, but I'm pretty sure we discussed this thing or looked at it or something, and I could see it being incredibly useful for students. Yeah, absolutely. As long as you have the discipline to do it, because That's another one of these bits you mentioned. You have to plug it in, you have to sync it, you have to put it on, you know, there's a little bit of overhead that comes with using this.
Oh yeah, because now, you know, when I have to worry about running out of paper, I can run out of ink, I can run out of battery life, and I can run out of memory. And so I just have to, you know, these things run out very rarely, actually. Because, you know, the ink lasts months, the battery lasts several days, and the memory lasts actually months also. But you have to be aware.
Yeah, and I could see, like, if we gave one of these to my daughter, she would use it sometimes, forget to use it sometimes. The whole uploading thing, it would run out of battery, she'd forget the paper, she'd probably lose the pen somewhere at some point. I don't know. I mean, it does take a certain kind of personality to take a device like this and make the maximal use out of it. And you know, and you could see a handful of changes that will probably come over time. You know, if let's say it had a cell connection and was constantly uploading to the cloud or something like that.
Actually, they're in their third generation of the pens, and the latest version has Wi-Fi built in.
Well, there you go.
And it does that.
There you go. So I could see that changing a lot and having a... very interesting devices. So let's take a break, and we'll come back, and we'll talk about Bergdahl, and that'll probably finish us up. So we'll be back after this. Okay, we're back. So this is an interesting story. There was one American POW in Afghanistan. It's been gone several years now. I forget how many years. Was it like 4 years?
Yeah.
5 years? 5 years.
Yeah.
There's an interesting story about how he went missing in the first place. Apparently, a lot of his comrades feel he basically just deserted. He was supposed to be on base. He left the base. He got picked up. And so he's been gone. And then the most recent development is that we got him back. And it was a trade for five inmates at Guantanamo. And apparently these were not five of the inmates at Guantanamo that have already been sort of declared as non-threatening. But on the other hand, these are folks that are fairly well recognized as senior Taliban leaders. Then there's some additional controversy over whether there were, in fact, laws in place that required Obama to give 30 days notice to Congress prior to releasing anybody from Guantanamo that were not followed. And then you've got the missing soldier's father, you know, has apparently been posting some things on social media that sound a little bit like he's sympathetic to the plight of the Taliban and what's going on in Afghanistan, although you can interpret that in different ways. I want to be clear there. There's just a lot of weirdness around these cases.
Yes, it's unfolded just in the last couple of days, and it's just, this is just so bizarre. And it just, normally I would be very much one way or another, but this is just I'm really torn on this whole issue.
I'm guessing, by the way, that there's a lot of this that just is not public yet that would fill in the blanks on a lot of the weirdness, but we may not know this, you know, for many months, if not ever, in some cases. Go ahead.
Did you see the father, Bob Bergdahl, speaking with the president?
I read more about it than I saw, but I saw some clips.
So I've been seeing on Facebook. Now I'm really kind of ashamed to say this, but on this, on Alan B. West's
okay
web page, I saw this on Facebook, and it has a video. And this is here's and another weird aspect is that when Bob Bergdahl spoke with the president standing right by his side,
yep.
He spoke in Arabic,
right,
to his son.
Yes,
and. And when he spoke, he gave the impression that he was speaking to his son, some sort of greeting. But looking at the translation, it wasn't that at all. And that now everyone's up in arms about how he had said something that means, in the name of Allah, the most gracious and merciful. And these are happen to be the same opening words on every chapter of the Quran. And so now this article claims to say that by uttering these words on the grounds of the White House, Bob Bergdahl has sanctified the White House and claimed it for Islam.
Oh, you know, that's ridiculous.
So, I can believe the translation, and I can understand that it's part of the Quran, but beyond that, it's bizarre for him to say something like that. And the fact that you look at,
you know, I can get,
and he's got this huge beard, like he looks like he's a Taliban himself.
Yeah, and so the word behind that was that he was doing one of these grow his beard in support of his son kind of things, like I'm not going to shave until my son comes home. Kind of things. And that was the explanation for it. But yeah, and then he was supposedly learning Arabic and Pashtun, etc., in order to sort of be able to sort of, I don't know.
Did he start negotiating? I haven't read all the articles. But.
Yeah, see, I have not read that explicitly, but I've got to think. He said it was sort of in solidarity and understanding what his son was going through and stuff like that. But I would not be surprised in the slightest if this was one of the situations where the parents were like, there's not enough movement going on. I'm going to get involved myself. And in order to get involved myself, I have to contact these people. I have to get it. I have to understand their culture. I have to be able to do communication. And I'm completely making shit up now. But there's just all so much weird stuff going on here that there's got to be something more to the story than what we're hearing so far.
Yeah, and you mentioned this too, but I'll go ahead and read what he had posted on Bob Bergdahl's Twitter account. He posted a tweet to a Balqi, I think is someone in Afghanistan. Quote, I am still working to free all Guantanamo prisoners. God will repay for the death of every Afghan child. Amen.
Right.
And that tweet was later deleted.
Da-da-da. Interesting. And because the other thing is, of course, you've got to think, you know, before the guy was standing next to the president in the White House, they did some sort of vetting of him. I would be shocked if they didn't know some of this stuff was going on. And you know, you wonder, are they completely blind to the optics of this? Because, of course, they could have gotten the guy back, but not made a big deal about it, not had the Rose Garden ceremony, because of not only, like, the weirdness around the parents, but also just the weirdness around, did this guy actually desert his post? Because you've got a lot of his comrades saying, you know, he deserted, and then we lost, you know, 6 soldiers trying to find this guy and get him back, and, you know, and why? He just walked off. He wanted to leave. I mean, there's a story, one of the stories say that right before he disappeared, he was telling people he was just going to leave and walk from Afghanistan to India.
Yeah, that's, it's, and yet, and that, the same time, with the release of those 5 Guantanamo prisoners, yeah, I'm all in favor of closing Guantanamo, and a lot of people have been, and Obama has been too. But really the five most dangerous of all the ones that are there. And now they're going to be, it's not like they're releasing them completely free. I think they're going to Qatar, and they were going to Qatar,
but apparently there's been a video circulating on social media of them arriving in Qatar and under absolutely no visible control. Like, it's not like they were being escorted in handcuffs to a new prison. They were getting out of a car with people, you know, yelling and screaming and welcoming them and stuff like that. So I don't know what the actual situation will be in Qatar after they get there.
Yeah, I think after a year they'll be completely not monitored, and right, they'll be free to do whatever they want, which is bizarre because, you know, Obama's got dozens of men who are cleared, who have been cleared by the administration to leave Guantanamo, and yet they're still being held there.
Right. I'm so conflicted about this as well. It's heartening to hear that you are too. Like, for instance, Obama letting these go, you know, there was a law passed and signed into law by the president that said he did have to give 30 days notice before releasing somebody from Guantanamo. The president issued one of these signing statements saying that under certain circumstances actually involved in prisoner exchange, it was actually explicitly in the signing statement that he believed this was an unconstitutional restraint on the president's power. But on the other hand, I have a fundamental opposition to the whole notion of signing statements. If you think it's unconstitutional, veto it.
Exactly.
You know, don't sign it and then say, yeah, I'll sign it, but I'm only going to pay attention to the parts I like. That's just not how you should do things. And so if there was a law on the books that says you have to give 30 days notice, then okay, I understand you might want to do this exchange because you're going to get the guy back, but you should be like, I want to do this, but my hands are tied by the law. I can't.
Yeah, it's called the rule of law. It's something that they don't quite understand in Washington.
Right, and this is unfortunately a completely bipartisan thing. So you have that, and then you have, you know, there were people saying today that this was essentially a trial run, because if he can get away with doing this, then he can get rid of everybody else in Guantanamo the same way.
As a trade?
Not necessarily by trades, but releasing them by executive order.
Well, yeah. I think that's fine for the ones that have been found to be just fine guys.
Yeah, I mean,
they don't have any evidence against
them.
There's
absolutely no excuse for those, as far as I'm concerned. The fact that we are still holding people that we have actually cleared is just ridiculous. Is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, you can make a case for the people who are quote unquote the worst of the worst, and you know they were up to bad things and blah blah blah. But the folks that we have actually cleared, we've gone through a process and said they're innocent of everything, and we're still keeping them.
Yeah, and then some of them, the excuse is, well, there's no country that will take them, even though we want to release them. But then I found out today on one of the podcasts I listened to that the president of Paraguay has offered to take any and all that they're willing to send.
Yeah. So anyway, lots of weirdness here, and I don't know. I have this feeling that, again, there's this huge depth under here of what is really going on. And one of the people involved, I guess it was actually the dad, said no one will ever really understand the complexities of this. It certainly seems that way. I mean, you got all kinds of people making political hay about this. But I think the real case here is, aside from a very few people who are involved, no one really knows what the hell actually happened here. I wouldn't be surprised if the dad was in deeper into this than is immediately obvious. I don't know.
I'm waiting for the movie.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing where eventually, 20 years down the line, the details will come out, and then, yeah, there should be a movie. Anyway, anything else to mention real quick? We said the Seattle minimum wage is going on. I don't know if you have any quick thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, I read an article last week about how the minimum wage is going in SeaTac, and the way businesses are responding is they're giving them their raise to $15 an hour to workers that were below that level, but they're taking at this particular like hotel that they interview people, they took away their 401k, they took right. away free parking, they took away the free food that they were able to get. So basically the businesses are saying, fine, you get your $15 an hour, but you get no benefits whatsoever.
Right, so that you make the net outlay by the company the same.
Yeah.
And that seems like a natural reaction. I mean, it's a different reaction. I mean, the most everybody says supply and demand curves, they'll just hire less people. This is another way to react to that. And what one of my, you know, my basic take on this is you can argue up and down all you want about, you know, the legitimacy or not of having a minimum wages, having government regulate these details. But, you know, my thought is, look, experiment, you know, we have a minimum wage anyway. The question is,
Daddy.
Yes, Alex, you want me to save your level on your game?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. I'll do that while I finish up here. before mommy gets up here. Yes. So is, you know, we have a minimum wage anyway. It's just a question of what the level is. And you have all these arguments about what will the effect be? Will it have these bad consequences? Will it have these good consequences? Will it raise everybody, or will it result in a disaster with people losing benefits or not being employed? Well, run the experiment and find out. I'm all for data. You know, if Seattle wants
Daddy.
To be a yes, Alex, I'm working on it. If Seattle wants to be a guinea pig and you know, have their people be
what did
the.
You call it?
I called it during podcast. There you go. Here, take it. If Seattle wants to be the guinea pig and let their people be the guinea pig and find out, so be it. And we'll collect data and we'll know better after this. Well, what really is the effect? Of course, part of this is different. Like if you have a city do this, you've got the possibility of flight right outside it. And so one of the arguments is for these things to be effective, they have to be universal, because otherwise companies just move to wherever.
And then they'll come up with excuses. Oh, it wasn't successful because of this and this, and we need to have everyone. Yeah, I can just see how the excuses will go if it does not go well for Seattle or SeaTac.
And here's the thing, even if it was everywhere, economies have a tendency to readjust themselves through inflation and other factors, so that, you know, you can change the, you know, okay, everybody is now making $15 an hour. Okay, well, in exchange, all the companies have to pay more for their employees, so they charge more for their products, so everything goes up, and you're right back where you came from, and you've changed the nominal you know, numbers involved, but you haven't actually changed anybody's situation. So, I don't know.
Let me bring this around full circle.
Yep.
As minimum wages are raised, and as it makes it unprofitable for companies to hire low-skilled workers, they will be forced to turn to automation.
Oh,
such
absolutely.
As self-driving cars, self-driving trucks, automatic food-making machines, all kinds of automation and robotics. And what will happen is...
There is almost nothing at a McDonald's that you could not automate if you were motivated to do so.
Yeah.
I mean, and if you, the reason there hasn't been automation in the fast food industry on any sort of large scale is because it hasn't been economic to do so. But if you raise the price of human labor, then the relative difference between that and doing the capital investment in robotics and AI research and whatever else you had to do to make it practical, that difference lessens. And eventually you tip the balance to say, okay, you know, people are really freaking expensive. We don't need 20 minimum wage workers in this restaurant. We need one manager and maybe a couple people to feed the raw ingredients into the machines.
Yep. And so we end up with an underclass that cannot get a job at all because the value that they can provide is below the minimum wage. And then we have welfare and social socialist economy because of that. It's
Like you said, though, when Yvonne and I were being pessimistic about the effects of automation, you said that you actually corrected us and said, well, every time this has happened in human history, the economy has actually adjusted around it, and you haven't had that effect. You've actually had all kinds of people given more opportunities and more ability to do things that were just not accessible before. And the automation actually, yes, it eliminates this class of jobs over here, but this whole other area of endeavor is opened up that people weren't even thinking about before. And I think you were actually right in that insight, in that, you know, these kinds of things may have very significant disruption in the short term. And unfortunately, the short term may in some cases be a generation. You may have a generation of lost people. But, you know, in the longer term, things end up being more positive. I mean, we have a better standard of living than we had 100 years ago, immense. It's not even comparable if you think about where we were 100 years ago or even 50 years ago in terms of many things. And automation is a big part of that. We don't have you can argue, for instance, that, you know, we used to have all kinds of people in very, very difficult, low-skill work that was dangerous and dirty, and a lot of those jobs have been automated, and those people might be better off without being in those jobs. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of complexities here, but it's an interesting dynamic system. And anyway, my bottom line on minimum wages is localities experimenting with various things, go for it. Experiment. Let's find out the data. Let's see what works. Let's see what doesn't work. And over time, we'll stop doing the things that don't work, and we'll do more of the things that do work.
That's called federalism.
Yep. Okay, I think we need to wrap it up at this point. So thank you very much for joining us again, Bruce. It was good to have you.
It's a pleasure, and I'm honored to be on your show.
Thank you very much. I enjoy
listening to you all every week.
We appreciate that, and you certainly give a little bit different perspective than Yvonne. As usual, everybody knows how to get a hold of us. I'm Abelsmay at Abelsmay.com. You can find me on Twitter at Abelsmay. You can find Bruce at BYUFan. And
my email is Bruce at BYU.net.
There you go. And Yvonne's not here this week, but he's at IMBO if you care to contact him. And we'll be back with Yvonne next week, as long as his house cooperates. Thanks, everybody, and have a great week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.